Welcome to the Buckmaster Show here on 1030 KVOI, The Voice, trusted local news and talk. I'm Dylan Smith, editor and publisher of TucsonSentinel.com, Tucson's independent source for authentically local news, sitting in for Bill, who's on a much-deserved birthday vacation. That was happened to be yesterday. Happy birthday, young man. Joining me here in the Green Things Zocalo Village studio is Paul Ingram, the senior reporter for TucsonSentinel.com. Great to have you here, Paul.
Good morning.
And morning. It's afternoon.
It's afternoon.
We need some more coffee here in the studio. Hopefully someone who has had enough coffee is Jim Small. He's the editor of the Arizona Mirror, joining us on the Buckmaster Live Line. Welcome, Jim.
Good afternoon.
So I really want to run through something that is a complex topic, and let's try and simplify that a little bit, Jim Small. There's a whole lot of stuff happening that's going to affect the state for the next decade. And what is that?
Well, that would be our redistricting, the once every decade redrawing of Arizona's political maps, the congressional maps and the legislative maps. And, you know, really it does determine, you know, a lot of like how these maps are drawn really does set the stage for what the next decade of political influence in the state will look like, certainly at the state capitol and also with the delegation that the state will send to Congress with our nine congressional seats.
So Arizona has what we call the Independent Redistricting Commission, which is a little bit of an unusual animal. It's was instituted by the voters as a constitutional amendment to basically keep politicians from completely drawing the lines in their own favor, right?
Yeah, essentially, back in 2000, voters pretty overwhelmingly approved the creation of this Independent Redistricting Commission, and the idea was really to take the task of drawing political lines out of the hands of the politicians. You know, one of the things that critics of lawmakers drawing districts have said is, you know, you end up in a situation where the politicians choose their voters instead of the voters choosing their politicians. And this was really one of the first in the nation, if not, it might have been the first in the nation, to go against that and to basically say, okay, we're going to take that power away from lawmakers and we're going to put it in the hands of an ostensibly independent commission and independent in the sense that it is not controlled by the legislature, not controlled by elected officials. The members, there's five members, two Republicans, two Democrats, and one independent. Legislative leaders in each party get to pick the Republicans and they get to pick the Democrats. And then those Republicans and Democrats pick an independent or what has always been an independent. I guess it technically has to be anyone who's not a Republican or Democrat. They pick an independent who serves as the chairperson of the commission. And the way the commission is structured is, you know, really that independent serves as the tie-breaking vote in almost all cases. You very often will find situations where the Republicans and Democrats have a different view of something, and so that independent works to either try to facilitate a compromise or, if one can't be reached, to really cast that tie-breaking vote and decide, you know, which of her colleagues are going to kind of end up winning any particular vote.
So even though this is nominally an independent process, it's still pretty political. You have the four, you know, people with declared political allegiances on that body trying to nudge lines in one direction or another to favor their party long term, right?
Oh, 100%. I mean, you know, I know that there are a lot of people who kind of view this and say, well, it's independent, it should be apolitical. I mean, that is unrealistic in my mind. I mean, this is really the most political act that any government does is drawing political boundaries. Just by its nature is political. Trying to take the politics all the way out of it is, you know, in my mind, it's kind of like trying to make water not wet. It doesn't really work. And what you end up with, you know, what you really are going to end up with in these situations is, you know, these fights by people who are not normally involved in politics. That is kind of the one aspect of it that is kind of, it divorces a lot of the political ambition from the drawing of the lines, at least direct political ambition. You don't have a state representative or a state senator drawing a line that she thinks is going to let her run for Congress, you know, in the next couple of years, or is going to make it a safe re-election campaign for their legislative campaign. And in fact, by definition, by rule, the Independent Redistricting Commission isn't even allowed to consider where incumbents live at all. They essentially wipe the map clean at the start of their process, and they start drawing lines from a completely blank map, and work to comply with voting rights rules and with a lot of other criteria that are laid out in the Constitution, and then go from there and try to essentially see what the maps look like at the end of the day. We're nearing the end of that process right now for this 10 years. I think that by next week we should have final maps approved. They've been meeting every day for 8 to 10 hours for the last several days, and they're going to continue that this week, and I think or today, and then continue that into the early part of next week as well.
And you guys have been covering that pretty extensively, really getting into the details of that. You mentioned one thing about lawmakers, they're not supposed to consider where they live so that they can have their own district. It certainly does seem like, well, we've seen some lawmakers, making suggestions about where the boundaries can be that favor them. In other instances, it seems pretty apparent that the incumbent in a district is kind of being taken into consideration. Is that just a byproduct of who elects them, or is there something more to that?
I think yes and no. I mean, so lawmakers are allowed to lobby the commission, right? Like, I mean, there's nothing that bars them from lobbying. It's really what this does is it takes the decision making out of the hands of the lawmakers, and it's something that we've seen in the past, right? I mean, I know 10 years ago, for instance, there was an outside group that was formed, and it was formed by Republican congressional members of Congress in Arizona, right? And their job, essentially what that group did is it continually lobbied for maps that were more favorable to those Republican members of Congress. So sometimes they'll band together and they'll do it through outside groups. Sometimes they will do it individually. I mean, the Redistricting Commission sought out the opinions and the thoughts from legislative leaders, for instance, last month, or maybe it was earlier this month, a couple weeks ago, and had them, come down and talk about like what they saw on the maps and what they liked and what they didn't like and what changes they would make or what advice they would give on things like that. And so the individual commissioners are certainly able to take, to put as much stock as they want to in that lobbying and in any of the other lobbying that happens. And there are groups that are dedicated solely, they exist solely to try to influence the maps and to try to get favorable maps for their interests, whether their interests are, Latino Democrats or they're Republicans or they are, maybe a business community group or something like that. So they all come to the commission with their ideas and, ultimately it's up to, more or less kind of trying to persuade that independent chairperson to come down on their side. And if they can make a good argument there, then they can get, if they can get her backing, then there's a really good chance that they're going to end up getting their way on the final map.
Jim, how much do you think that the Voting Rights Act and some of the restrictions based around that are actually affecting this redistricting effort?
Oh, they always do, and they do in a different way this time than they have in the past. In the last two times we've done this independent redistricting, Arizona was subject to what's known as preclearance under the Federal Voting Rights Act, which basically meant that any change to election law or procedure that the state wanted to make had to be sent to the U.S. Department of Justice and had to be signed off on before it could be implemented. And the effect of that was that a lot of things got the state was told you can't do that. And that applied to everything from changing an election law to moving a polling site to drawing new political boundaries. And one of the things that's different this time is that in 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down that entire section of the Voting Rights Act and gutted it and got rid of the idea of preclearance. So Arizona no longer has to get approval for any changes it wants to make. And that's one of the reasons you've seen a huge raft of new voting laws proposed, as well as new voting laws passed. And as it pertains to redistricting, what it means is that when they go and they draw these maps, they no longer have to send them to the federal government and get the federal government to approve them before they institute them. And so that gives them a little bit more flexibility and freedom to do different things that otherwise wouldn't have been allowed. And I think a really good example of that is what's happening in northern Arizona, where you have this congressional district, what is currently Congressional District 1, represented by Tom O'Halloran. And that district includes, when it was crafted 10 years ago, it was designed to incorporate as many tribal communities as possible. And it was designed to give tribal members and tribal voters the ability to have as much influence as possible over their chosen candidate and be able to pick the candidate that they wanted. And similarly, there was a similar choice made on the legislative map. Well, this time with no preclearance, the maps are looking a lot different, and you're not having as much attention paid to those tribal communities, and as a result, you're having, you know, a lot of these Native American nations and tribes are coming to the redistricting commission and saying, hey, look, we don't want you. You're taking away our political power, and you're putting us into districts where we're never going to have the ability to choose our candidates. On the legislative map, right now, as it's constructed, that district includes Flagstaff. Flagstaff and, say, the Navajo Nation and the Hopi Nation, both predominantly Democratic, no doubt about it. They're going to vote very solidly blue, but the population is such that there are more voters in Flagstaff than there are from the tribal communities. And as a result, that means the voters in Flagstaff really have the say over who gets out of the primary. We saw a similar map 20 years ago, and the result was that Native American voters really didn't have the ability to pick their candidates. And you got a lot of white Democrats from Flagstaff who were representing tribal communities. And, you know, that left a lot of the tribal voters, kind of wondering whether their vote even mattered. And so that's been, a real strong point of contention over the last couple of weeks in particular.
Sure. During some of the hearings, there was a lot of conversation about the idea of communities of interest. Can you talk a little bit about that and how maybe the commission is responding or not responding to that idea?
Yeah, so communities of interest is one of the constitutional criteria, and one of six. And it is, if it sounds vague and nebulous, it's because it is extremely vague and nebulous. No one really knows what a community of interest is, and in large part, of a community of interest is kind of like whatever you say it is. We've heard as the redistricting commission toured the state and got public input, both before it started drawing maps and after it approved its initial draft maps, just about everybody had an opinion on what their community of interest is. For some people, it's purely political. I'm a Republican and I want to live in a district where Republicans are going to be dominant. Okay. For some people, it's, related to, more policy issues, like it's water issues or it's agriculture. You live in rural Arizona, so you're dealing with the same, agricultural issues, perhaps. For others, it's, well, I live over in this part of Tucson, but I go shopping in this part of Tucson, so that's my community of interest is that area. And essentially, it's a very fluid term, and really what it's designed to get at is the idea is to determine which communities have common interests and not divide communities that are linked in some way, except where you absolutely have to. Ultimately, I think it's a little impossible. I mean, you have to put lines somewhere, and every time you put a line down, you're going to be dividing something, and someone in that district is going to feel a connection to something outside of that district. More practically speaking, generally, if you've heard people approach the redistricting commission and talk about communities of interest, more often than not, that's been a Democratic talking point. I think it's kind of been used as a way to talk about, trying to compete, it's been a Republican talking point, right? Communities of interest, whereas Democrats have largely talked mostly openly about competitiveness, which makes sense considering that they are the minority party in the state.
I want to dig into a little bit more specifically about some of those lines down here in Tucson. But first, we need to hear a message from some of our fine Buckmaster Show sponsors. And right now, We'll be back in a moment with Jim Small, the Arizona Mirror. I'm Dylan Smith from TucsonSentinel.com, joined by Paul Ingram from TucsonSentinel.com. This portion of the Buckmaster Show is presented by Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle. Mona's is located on the northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. We can talk about what district they're going to be in when we get back. Mona's is open Tuesday through Sunday for breakfast and lunch. During this holiday season, treat yourself to their mouthwatering pastries, including that famous Danish Kringle. Check out monasdanishbakery.com or buckmastershow.com for a link to Mona's Danish Bakery.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. This is Bill Buckmaster. You've heard me talk about choosing Tucson International Airport. While fewer people are traveling lately, our airport is doing even more these days to help ensure traveler health safety, including counter safety shields, physical distancing markers, enhanced cleaning, and more. It's called TUS Cares, and you can learn more at flytucson.com. These may be different times, but my priority remains to fly Tucson, Tucson International Airport.
The Regional Transportation Authority celebrates 15 years of project delivery to the Greater Tucson region. As promised, the RTA has delivered nearly 900 projects from its 20-year 2006 voter-approved regional transportation plan, which is funded by a half-cent RTA tax. The RTA is committed to deliver the remaining plan projects. Learn more about the RTA's economic benefits at rtamobility.com.
Are you searching for a sumptuous suite on the Italian Riviera, an exploration of the mighty Mississippi, or an indulgent spa in Cancun? Bon Voyage Travel will help you find exactly the vacation you're looking for anywhere in the world. With many cruises setting sail in over 1,100 hotels and resorts to choose from with our exclusive benefits, Bon Voyage Travel's experienced advisors are here to guide you every step of the way. Visit bvtravel.com or call 797-1110.
Green Things is a family-owned and operated plant nursery serving Tucson since 1970. Open daily at 3384 East River Road, Green Things is chock-full of plants and pottery from around the world. Green Things is also now home to Zocalo, featuring fine Mexican and South American imports spread over five buildings on the 13-acre Green Things property. For more, visit greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Southern Arizona is home to one of the world's most trusted sources of information on medicines. The Credible Meds website is visited each day by over 2,000 people from more than 60 countries. You too can learn how to personalize your medications and take control of your health care. Visit CredibleMeds.org today and join Bill Buckmaster each month as he and Dr. Ray Woosley, founder of Credible Meds, give you practical tips on how to get the most from your medications.
Welcome back to the Buckmaster Show here on KVOI The Voice, trusted local news and talk. I'm Dylan Smith, editor and publisher of TucsonSentinel.com, sitting in for Bill, who's on vacation. I'm joined here in the Green Things Zocalo Village studio by our senior reporter at the Sentinel, Paul Ingram. And on the Buckmaster Show live line, we have Jim Small, editor of the Arizona Mirror, sharing some of his expertise on redistricting. If you have got a question or a comment, something you'd like us to dig into and clarify, give us a ring on the Buckmaster live line, which is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. That's 520-790-2040. Jim Small, a real point of contention, I guess, especially during yesterday's very long hearing, was exactly where Tucson is going to be split up for those congressional districts. Is it going to be along Campbell? Is it going to be along Alvernon? Sort of wiggling in between. What's going on there?
Yeah, that has been, for quite a while, has been really a point of contention. I mean, I think the Tucson boundaries and both maps really have been places where they've been fighting fighting over. I mean, essentially what it comes down to is on the congressional maps, you've got the district that kind of pulls in to the western side of Tucson that is what's known as the VRA district, the voting rights district. It's a heavily Latino district. And then the district that takes in the eastern portions of Tucson and kind of stretches off toward the eastern part of the state and southeastern part of the state is a nominally competitive district right now. Republicans have a slight edge on it. And really the issue comes down to, you know, where do you set the boundary between those two districts? And there's a lot at stake there, right? Because you've got on the western side, you've got a district that is solidly blue and is going to continue to stay blue no matter what happens. And on the right side, you've got a district that is, you know, shades of purple, and the Democrats, of course, want that to be more purple, and the Republicans want that to be more red. And so what you end up with is this fight, right? Democrats want the boundary to be at Campbell, because that would, in essence, you know, leave, you know, a number of very heavily Democratic neighborhoods and push them into that eastern district. And Republicans, of course, don't want that. They'd rather put those Democrats in with all the other Democrats and can keep, you know, give themselves a little bit more of an advantage. We're talking about a couple of percentage points here. But at the end of the day, that's really when you get down to brass tacks on redistricting, that's what the fights end up being over is, you know, where does a boundary go? Which street does it go on? Which neighborhoods get moved from one district to another? And it's, you know, it has attention. And I think Democrats have viewed this map, you know, they came out of the meeting yesterday and really were complaining about the fact that the congressional map looked like it was essentially structured to be a potential 7-2 Republican advantage, depending on how elections go. And, you know, in a state where Republicans, Democrats, and independents are roughly split a third, a third, and a third, that was something that was really upsetting. I think the Democrats watching what happened yesterday.
Looking at the draft maps as they're being discussed and crafted, one of the sort of weird districts starts right down the street from me, basically at Grant and I-10 on the corner there, and runs up through Casa Grande all the way to Baseline Road, where it ends at the Salt River around 91st. I don't know, is that 91st Street or Avenue? I've never even been
Avenue
there.
Be,
I'm afraid
that's, it would be Avenue. Yeah,
that's
be
that,
Avenue.
That's a very weird looking district. What does somebody have in common who lives, you know, out in the, you know, dusty western reaches of the Phoenix suburbs have to do with somebody who, you know, lives way down here in Tucson?
Yeah, you know, and this is why redistricting is frankly just so complicated, right? Because, you know, when you're talking about congressional maps in particular, so we've got, you know, 7-point-something million people in our state. We have 9 districts. That means when you're dividing these districts, they all have to have, I want to say it's something like 924,000 people. And they have to be down to almost the person based on census counts. There's very little leeway given for different population sizes in these congressional districts. And in a state like Arizona, what you end up with, you know, we've got 2 really large urban centers and then a couple of kind of smaller ones like Flagstaff and Prescott. You know, but you have Phoenix and Tucson, and they're the anchors, and they're going to be the anchors of a lot of districts. But in order to hit that 900,000 people, especially coming out of Pima County, you could obviously make one district out of the Pima County area and achieve that, but that's not an ideal situation, and that also wouldn't do anything for complying with the Voting Rights Act requirements. That still do exist, even though there's no pre-clearance. They still, you know, can't decide that we're not going to make any districts that don't let Latinos, for instance, elect their candidates of choice. That would be an instant lawsuit, and you'd be, you know, kicked out of court with that. So what you end up having to do is to draw these lines, and you have these districts that are anchored in urban centers, and then that spread out into the more rural parts of the state. And into the areas where there's less population, but you need to pick up a lot of geography in order to get to the needed population number. And you know, the district currently, Raul Grijalva's district right now, right, stretches up. My in-laws live in the southwest part of the Phoenix area, and they're in Raul Grijalva's district.
Over in the Maryville area, right?
They live south of that. They live like south of I-10 and kind of like, you know, in you know, what used to be cattle country out in the Southwest.
A lot of people think of Grijalva as, you know, the congressman from Tucson, and, you know, maybe, you know, Western Arizona, the Yuma area, and don't know that that district goes all the way to Phoenix right now. We also have the crazy district that touches the north edge of the Tucson area and runs all the way up to Utah right now.
Yes, absolutely. And that's, you know, as population density gets lower, then you end up with these really large geographies, right? Like, I mean, the first district, the Tom O'Halloran district right now, I mean, I did the math on it. I think it's like if it was its own state, it would be the 15th largest state in the country. Like, it's that big, you know, it's bigger than Indiana. Like, it is like one district that's that huge, but it doesn't have any urban centers, you know, and it doesn't have population density. It's, you know, it runs from north of the Grand Canyon to the Four Corners all the way down south and pulls in Pinal County and pulls in parts of Pima County and, you know, basically the bulk of eastern Arizona. And it is a geographically huge district, but in terms of population, it's roughly, or it was when it was drawn, it was basically the exact same size as the districts in Tucson or the districts in Phoenix. And that's just, you know, one of the real challenges I think that anyone drawing maps is going to face. Is how do you even these things out? And ultimately, that does mean there's not really a way around it to say that you're going to end up, in a lot of cases, if you're not in an urban center, that you're going to end up in a district where you look at it and you go, why in the world am I connected to these folks? You know, like, why are people in Glendale, in the western part of Phoenix, why are they connected to, you know, maybe to folks in Yuma or to folks in Lake Havasu City in their same district? Well, it's just because the lines have to go somewhere and the people have to go somewhere.
One of the things that I think is interesting, I mean, there was quite a big question about how the census was done, in the sense that the census may have undercounted the number of actual Arizona residents. Do you have some sense about how that might affect the redistricting effort? I mean, are we maybe we don't have quite the idea of population that we should?
Oh, yeah. No, I think that, you know, there's little doubt in anyone's mind that Arizona was pretty massively undercounted in the census. I mean, to the tune of, I think I've seen some estimates that they, it could have been, you know, 200 to 400,000 people less. And had we gotten a more accurate count and had the figures, the population figures come in where people anticipated they would, we would have actually gotten a 10th congressional district. And that would be huge because it would make the districts smaller, make them more compact geographically, and also, you know, have, you know, fewer, nominally fewer people in them, which would have made the job of drawing districts much different than it is right now. And you know, you still would have, you're always going to have large rural districts, but they might not have been as large. Instead of being 920,000 people, it might have only been, you know, something like 850,000 people. And that's a big difference.
And the reason we have to redraw them and we can't just leave them as they've been for the past decade is even though we're not getting a new member of Congress, but different areas grew at different rates. There were, you know, definitely more growth around Phoenix kind of changes how things need to be divided up, right?
Oh, absolutely. And it's actually required. The Constitution requires the congressional lines to be drawn every 10 years. But
they could have just said, well, these are good enough. We'll draw them again exactly the same way.
Well, except for that pesky voter approved independent redistricting commission, I suppose that's possible, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, the congressional lines need to be redrawn just for exactly what you talked about, for redistributing the population growth. I think every 10 years, I mean, there are those areas of any state that grow faster or of any, you know, any county. I mean, the counties are going to go through the same thing, right? The cities will as well, because they need to redistribute their population based on where people moved to or moved out of, or, you know, which areas got a lot of housing over the past decade and saw an influx of population. It's important to do that just to maintain the fact, to ensure the fact that voters have, you know, their ballots count equally when they go to select their legislators or select their city council people or select their county supervisors.
Somewhat naturally, we've been talking a whole lot about the congressional boundaries. That's, you know, more high profile. That gets people more worked up. Also in play right now are all of the boundaries for the legislative districts where we vote on our, you know, members of the state house and the state senate. Is the same sort of pattern playing out there, where the working results as they stand are favoring the Republicans?
That was true, I think, until like 2 hours ago. Yes, I would have, the answer to that would have been a resounding yes. Obviously, they're meeting right now while we're talking.
Yeah.
They just came back from a lunch break, but they've been meeting all morning. And I think for the most part, you've generally seen, you know, that when there have been tie votes between the Republicans and Democrats, the independent chairwoman has almost entirely sided with the Republicans. And that's really until like the last couple of days. She started to side with the Democrats on some of the issues. And, you know, the legislative maps, have been, I think, generally favoring Republicans. I think they've been the one that they were working on yesterday and to start this morning. I think it had 13 safe R districts, 12 safe D districts, and then there were, I think, five. I think that would leave five competitive districts, but all of those districts lean to the Republicans. Some very little, and some a little. Some, you know, a little bit more, to kind of stretching the edge of what a competitive district would be. But a couple hours ago, they voted to move forward, and the districts are much more. They're I think 13 safe blue districts, 12 safe red districts, and of the five competitive districts, I think two of them lean slightly D, and the other three lean slightly R. Far more evenly split districts than what they have been working with, and that was a map proposed by the Democrats on the commission, and the chairwoman sided with that, and she explicitly said that she thought that that map did a better job of representing minority voting interests than the Republican map did, and so she voted for it to move forward, and that's what they're kind of working off of right now. So it'll be interesting to see how this develops today and moving into next week.
You said that the commissioner is often siding with Republicans on one side and the others. I mean, do you get a sense they're making better arguments? They have better data? What's kind of bringing the commission to one side or the other, do you think?
You know, I think for a while what we were seeing on the commission was, the two commissioners from Pima County, one's a Democrat, Shireen Lerner, and one's a Republican, David Mell. And what we've been seeing them fight an awful lot. They're the two most vocal commissioners, and they'd been quibbling and arguing over a number of different things, whether it was in the boundaries in Pima County, or the boundaries up in northern Arizona, or in the East Valley in the Phoenix area, or in Yuma. They'd been on opposing sides pretty consistently, and there were for a long time what we saw was Shireen, or the Democratic commissioner, kept kind of going back to things and wanting to relitigate decisions that had been made. And there were decisions that the chairwoman, the independent chairwoman, Erica Newberg, had been pretty emphatic. She said, like, I don't like this idea and I'm not going to ever support it. But they kept bringing it up and they kept kind of proposing it. And so all of the proposals that were coming forward from Democrats were, here's the things we've been arguing about. And, oh, yeah, here's all these things we've already decided on that we don't like, that we want to change. And this most recent map, the one that the chairwoman sided with the Democrats on, Those things weren't on the map. Suddenly, they were making points about the arguments were really limited to just kind of new topics or topics that hadn't been resolved yet, and they didn't attempt to go back and change a decision that had been made a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago. And I think from an observer's perspective, it seemed as though that might have made the difference. And suddenly, it wasn't them trying to claw back previous votes; it was them trying to move the map forward in a new direction and just accept the fact that they'd lost. Their arguments weren't persuasive enough on those other issues, and to really just leave those, let those sleeping dogs lie.
One thing that earlier you'd said there were six requirements for the districting. What are all the six requirements, the six things that they have to balance against each other?
You're going to make me look these up. They go in an order actually, and they're put in an order by the state constitution, and it's an important thing for them to.
I've got them right here. They're actually in the story you guys published on the Arizona Mirror earlier this morning. They are.
Yeah, see, they should have been in there. Yeah.
Equal populations, the Voting Rights Act, compactness, respect for geographic and political boundaries, communities of interest, and competitiveness. You can find that on the Arizona Mirror, and I'm going to be checking back with you guys later this afternoon. I'm sure you guys will have an update, Jim Small, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that this meeting will run until 5 o'clock or something like all the rest of them have been. So the update's going to be, I'm sure, several hours after that once we kind of make sense of what they've done.
Well, thanks very much for giving us this look into what is a kind of tangled, complex, but important issue. Jim Small, the Arizona Mirror. Thanks very much.
Hey, thank you.
Take care. We will be right back here on the Buckmaster Show.
Vero Amore Restaurant in Plaza Palomino at Fort Lowland Swan and Dove Mountain in Marana are now open for limited in-restaurant and patio dining, along with takeout and home delivery. All of your favorite Vero Amore menu items, including Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza, are ready for you and your friends and family. More at veroamorepizza.com.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Hi, this is Pam Krim, CEO of the Better Business Bureau of Southern Arizona, where we set the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the place to turn for objective and unbiased information on businesses. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau of Southern Arizona at bbb.org/Tucson.
As a small business owner, I appreciate the services of a top-notch certified public accountant. That's why Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates is the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Michael's a former Small Business Leader of the Year in Tucson. He'll professionally handle all of your accounting needs and tax preparation services. Flowers, Rieger & Associates, 6125 East Grant Road, and on the web, flowersrieger.com. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is once again welcoming guests to the gallery. Stop by or call ahead for a one-on-one appointment or even a virtual design session. Come by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, located at the southwest corner of Fort Lowell and Dodge. The number is 795-8226 and on the web at moesgallery.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
Welcome back to the Buckmaster Show here on 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. I'm Dylan Smith, the editor and publisher of TucsonSentinel.com, sitting in for Bill, who's on a birthday vacation this week. Joining me here in the Green Things Zocalo Village studio is our senior reporter at the Sentinel, Paul Ingram. Thanks for taking the time today, Paul. I know you're busy trying to get some reporting done. as well.
Yeah, trying to.
And many thanks to Jim Small, the editor of the Arizona Mirror, for calling in on the Buckmaster Live Line and sharing some of his deep, hard-won expertise about the ongoing tangle of Arizona's redistricting process. That's we'll see how things play out. I don't know if he's correct that we will have some final maps done by next week, but maybe we will be a little closer to the finish line.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll get there eventually. I mean, there's a deadline coming, so they have to at some point decide what we're going to do and what it's going to look like in the future, at least for the next 10 years.
And then there might be some lawsuits following after that.
There's certainly to be some lawsuits.
One of the big stories of the week was actually something that experts all expected, and that was the first case of that new variant of COVID-19 being confirmed here in Pima County. Tell us a little bit about that, Paul.
Sure. This week, the Pima County was able to confirm the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. So mid-November, researchers in South Africa actually identified the virus. They have a really good, robust system for looking for viruses, really because they were worried about hemorrhagic fevers. So they were able to detect the virus and really show that they had it. And it started to pop up all throughout the world. It's in more than 32 states, and it's been in dozens of countries across the world. So we really do see it. And the expectation was we would see an Omicron case in the county soon. It's important to know that county uses a series of tests. They use PCR tests, which are tests for coronavirus. And then they send those tests out, up to a lab, and that lab actually looks for variants. So they've been doing this process since last year.
But they're not doing that with every single test that's run. So
correct.
This is kind of based off of a sample?
Correct, exactly. It's a sample of tests. So we get at least some sense. The thing to keep in mind is, of course, since they showed that we have one case, that means that we probably have multiple cases, and that case has been here for several days, if not a couple of weeks, depending on when the test was done. So we all knew this was coming, and that it's finally here. It's just like the Delta variant, which took a little bit of time to actually get to Pima County, and just like coronavirus itself, which really took from, you know, February, the first case was in the U.S., and in March, we had our first case here in Pima County.
And this new variant of COVID, there are still a great many open questions about it. It seems to be a lot more infectious. It spreads more rapidly, more easily. How serious people fall ill from it, what the long-term effects are, we don't really know yet, do we?
That's exactly right. I mean, it seems to be about 7 to 17 times as infectious as
17
Delta.
Times?
Up to 17 times.
Wow.
Yeah. And that depends. And we're still trying to really understand what the virus does and how it behaves, and really how it behaves against vaccinations and masks and other public health attempts to kind of mitigate the virus. So we don't really know. One good sign is that research from South Africa seems to show that maybe there'll be fewer hospitalizations. So at least it seems like this virus has followed some of the tracks of other viruses, which that it gets more virulence because that's its best way to keep spreading, but it also tends to be less deadly. So maybe we'll have to see where we end up. And the worrisome thing is that we're already kind of in trouble when it comes with coronavirus and hospitals. Hospitals are overloaded. The head of Banner Health Network, which has about 30 hospitals, including a bunch of in Arizona, you know, they really said hospitals are already overloaded. They're overloaded because there are too many cases. ICUs are full, and they've started to lose staff really because they've gone through more than 18 months of dealing with COVID, and it's really difficult work. They spend a lot of time in PPE. It's just difficult to do. And they're also really, some nurses and doctors have said that they really want to leave because they see that, you know, people are still getting coronavirus, even though we've had vaccines for most people going on 10 months.
And there are, at this point, I believe, maybe pushing 60% of Arizonans are fully vaccinated. Still not the kind of numbers that officials say we need to put a damper on things.
Yeah, one of the hard things about Arizona's vaccinations is that there's a pretty big variation between the vaccination rate in each county. Santa Cruz County had a vaccination rate that was up 99%. They were essentially had vaccinated more people than they had in the county because they're doing vaccinations for people in other counties and with people in Mexico. And now, once they added the vaccinations for kids 5 to 11, their vaccination overall rate went down, but still they're at 95%. Nationwide, we're at about 78%. And in Pima County, we're at about 66%, so roughly two-thirds. Now, the thing to keep in mind is that Mojave County is down around 40. So we see this big variation. So that's one of the things that's hard for the state is, well, you know, if you're in Santa Cruz County, almost everybody is vaccinated. And really it comes down to you're talking about just a few people who aren't, where in a county like Mojave, most people aren't vaccinated. So that variation is really troublesome. And that's probably causing it. One thing that, you know, the folks at Banner said is that most of the people who were in the ICU were not vaccinated. So we really do see that, and even with Omicron, we really see the vaccination's pretty effective.
There was, I was told yesterday, there was one recent night in the last few days where there were just two open ICU beds in all of Pima County hospitals. Everything else was full.
Right. And one thing that's really hard is that, you know, that's, there's also the problem of, as other states have really high numbers of cases, the ability to move people around to create room decreases. And the thing to keep in mind is this means that if there's, say, a large car accident, then that means there may not be beds in that particular place. And, you know, this affects not just the big hospitals like, you know, Banner, UMC, and also the big hospitals in Phoenix, but also affects local ones. I mean, Cochise County has said that they're essentially in crisis mode, and they've said that for a long while. And we've really seen that all the hospitals are reporting that they're in a really tough condition, and they're heading towards being in crisis care centers. And that means that we're going to have the ability to try to move other people around. That means the people who are having like surgeries, you know, they're really not going to be able to necessarily be in, have a bed available. So some surgeries are going to be kicked back. Some people aren't going to get the care that they need right away because the wards are full of COVID cases.
We've only got a very short bit of time left, but we should mention a couple of things. Both the city of Tucson and Pima County have used a carrot and stick approach to try and encourage their government workers to be vaccinated. Pima County said recently that they were pushing 500 employees that they were going to fire, people who work with vulnerable populations who had not been vaccinated. Seems like that number has gone down quite a bit as more people have gotten their shots.
Yeah, that number has really been dropping. I mean, as the really once I think the stick appears, people start really shifting how they're going to think. It's well and good to feel like you're willing to lose your job, you know, when it's kind of an idea, but when people really say, here's your papers, all of a sudden people seem to start changing their mind. So, you know, really, and keep in mind, I mean, in the county, most people got vaccinated, but there's a big variation. I mean, some offices are at 100%, but the sheriff's department is around 67%.
Yeah. Last week, there were about 200 folks in the sheriff's department, mostly corrections officers at the jail who were being told they were going to be fired. Is since then, quite a number of them. It dropped to the beginning of the week. There were about 150. And then I think I spoke with Sheriff Chris Nanos this morning. He said that out of 120 notices of intent to terminate letters that they'd handed out, just 14 of those people indicated that they were not going to go get their shots. And he has said they had about 20 more notices to deliver in the next few days. So that number's changing pretty rapidly. Speaking of those mandates, Governor Doug Ducey quietly did something this week.
Yeah, so this week, Doug Ducey, he used this, it's called the Enhanced Surveillance Agreement. It's an executive order that he puts out. And what essentially one of the things included is this idea that cities, counties, and other agencies can't require vaccinations. And the thing about it is that he essentially copied the language from the same kind of document that he put out in October. So in a lot of ways, I mean, most of the city essentially said, well, we're going to keep doing this anyways. We're almost through our process. And the county's roughly through it. So in a lot of ways, it didn't really have maybe an effect. But it's still interesting that he's including that, especially in a document that essentially says we have thousands of COVID cases. We're in trouble and we need to do better work. We need to have better information. But, you know, we can't require vaccines.
Especially city officials completely rebuffed his attempt this week to keep them from instituting their mandate. City Councilman Steve Kozajic just said, well, that's illegal.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that may be a continuing bone of contention between the Republican governor and the Democrats here in Pima County. We will be right back here on the Buckmaster Show with Weekend Watch. Stay tuned.
Tucson's original gastropub, Noble Hops in Oro Valley, proudly announces a second Tucson area location where you'll enjoy locally brewed craft beer and gastropub fine fare. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies, on West Lambert Lane at North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley, and now at the Doubletree Hotel on Alvernon across from Tucson's Reed Park. More on the web at noblehops.com. When the public weighed in on the first draft of the Regional Transportation Authority Plan, the RTA responded by revising the final plan before voter approval in 2006. The RTA is preparing for a new plan for voter consideration by June 2026 and invites your input on regional transportation priorities. A draft plan will be presented for further public review. Submit your input or learn more at rtanext.com. Vets working hard to save wildlife covered in cactus spines. A skunk left for dead, miraculously saved by a caring citizen. Those are just a couple of the headlines from the nonprofit Tucson Animal Rescue Center, where thousands of animals are cared for each year at its state-of-the-art Far East Side Tucson facility. Rescue, rehab, and release. The Tucson Wildlife Center, saving wildlife for more than two decades. Donate online at TucsonWildlife.com or call 290-WILD.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Hello, I'm Danette Bewley, CEO of the Tucson Airport Authority. At Tucson International Airport, we're nonstop supporting jobs and prosperity as an economic engine for our entire region. From an innovative and touchless passenger experience to earning the GBAC Star Accreditation, the golden standard for cleanliness, our team is ready to welcome you back to Tucson International Airport. Begin your journey with us. We're nonstop for you, Southern Arizona.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
Welcome back to the Buckmaster Show. I'm Dylan Smith, editor and publisher of TucsonSentinel.com, sitting in for Bill, who's on vacation. I got to let you know, our friends over in Silver City and Grant County are ready to welcome you back with open arms. Just 3 hours east of Tucson, there's so much to do in Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico, including hiking in the Gila National Wilderness, where there's plenty of social distancing, and visiting the world-famous Cliff Dwellings National Monument. For a complete listing of the many things to do and great places to stay, visit southwestnewmexico.org. Here to tell us a couple of things to do this weekend, a little bit closer to home, Matt Russell with Weekend Watch. So what's on tap, Matt?
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, two of the basic food groups on my personal pyramid are chicken wings and ribs, which is why I'm thrilled to announce a new restaurant is open in town that has built a business on both. It's called Flaps and Racks, and they feature an impressive menu of wings and several options, a Korean twist on ribs, as well as something I've never heard of, pork wings, which kind of are the best of both worlds. So Flaps and Racks is open on Valencia near Country Club, but got my pick for the weekend.
Excellent. You've got one more thing that you were telling me about a little bit earlier that maybe the large Buckmaster Show radio audience needs to hear about and head on over to this weekend.
Well, absolutely. The holiday season continues this weekend. It's the West Side Wonderland at Anita's Street Market on North Anita Avenue. Tomorrow from 11 to 2, you've got Santa hanging out toys. There's going to be free hot dogs, raffle prizes, all the holiday festivity that can be mustered starting the 1 week countdown to Christmas. And speaking of mustard, did I mention the free hot dogs, Dylan? It's the West Side Wonderland at Anita's Street Market tomorrow afternoon.
Right on. And there was one more thing over not too far away from that, over at Main Gate.
Absolutely. It's the Main Gate Holiday Boulevard Bash from 12 to 5 on Sunday. There's going to be a Santa sleigh sighting, a poinsettia tree, Hot Cocoa stations, the Tucson Girls Chorus is going to perform, cookie decorating booths, specials in food and beverage across Main Gate Square. University Boulevard is going to be transformed into Holiday Boulevard for this big bash on Sunday afternoon.
And we finally have some crisp, cool weather out there, so these outdoor holiday events will seem a little bit more seasonal in an appropriate way, right?
Indeed, absolutely. Getting into our sense of place.
Thank you very much, Matt Russell, with Weekend Watch. The Buckmaster
Cheers,
Show
Dylan.
Is produced by Bill Buckmaster Communications, LLC, which is responsible for its content. I'm Dylan Smith of TucsonSentinel.com, sitting in for Bill. And on behalf of Bill and longtime executive assistant Rosemary Prant and the entire team here at Bustos Media Tucson, including engineer, producer, man of all seasons, Tom Fairbanks, have a wonderful and safe weekend and very happy holidays. Take care, folks.